I'm speaking with Andrew Harvey. He's author of The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism. We will take a brief musical break. You can check out more about Andrew Harvey on www.andrewharvey.net. You're listening to The Great Leap Forward. My name is John Malkin. You can hear this program every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. My guest this evening is Andrew Harvey, author of The Hope, a guide to sacred activism. And Andrew, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
I'd like now to talk with you about nonviolence. And in The Hope, you write that as a race, we have begun to believe that the only way to achieve anything is through the use of force. This is the most dangerous of illusions, as wars and genocides prove. And then you write that, I am not a dogmatic pacifist, however. In certain extreme situations, which I pray do not arise, but could, I would be prepared to take up arms and use force. Talk about the power of nonviolence as we've seen manifest through Gandhi and Rosa Parks, Cesar Chavez, Rigoberto Menchu, and others, and this paradox, though, that is within nonviolence itself of the possibility in extreme cases of using force.
Well, I think on the one hand, we saw in the 20th century astonishingly powerful people like Gandhi, like Martin Luther King, like Nelson Mandela, like Desmond Tutu, like all the wonderful beings you mentioned, and like, of course, the His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who really showed us that through pursuing nonviolence with great spiritual strength, astonishing shifts in history could take place. So I think what I believe is that everybody should, as far as possible, pursue the path of nonviolence and pursue the kind of inner spiritual practices that can give you the strength to be compassionate, be generous, be peaceful, be all-embracing, and be focused, even in extreme circumstances. Because I think history has shown that when people pursue their goals and causes with such a divine fervor and such a divine passion and peace, the divine blesses those causes, and over time they do have a very extraordinary strong chance of becoming realized. I also believe, however, that given the situation as it is, given the omnipotence of the corporations, given the strength of the military-industrial complex, given the horror that is manifesting through that all over the world, we might, and I say might, be brought to a situation so extreme, so terrible, so horrible, that even those of us who have committed ourselves to nonviolence would then consider that a disciplined and focused and economic use of force would be necessary. When I interviewed His Holiness the Dalai Lama on the day he won the Nobel Prize in 1989, he surprised me by saying that he wasn't a dogmatic pacifist, because in the Tibetan Bodhisattva tradition, there are very rare and very unusual cases of Bodhisattvas who did, on extremely rare occasions, employ force when it was absolutely the last resort. And then he said something which permanently changed my mind. If you ever have the grace to sit with the Dalai Lama and to talk with him, he will say something that will permanently change your mind. And what he said was that if it comes to the necessity of using force, only those people could be trusted to use force in a way that could work to change the situation who had been profoundly and over a long time and with deep spiritual intensity trained in nonviolence. Because only a person who was truly calm and truly centered in God could ever be trusted to use the very dangerous weapon of violence. This is exactly the same message, of course, that Krishna gives Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. You remember that the Bhagavad Gita is not a pacifist document. It is about the divine appearing to a warrior who is deeply sad at having to go into battle, where if he wins, he will probably kill not only his relations, but also his own master, the most sacred of all relationships. And what the divine, through Krishna, his charioteer, tells him is that he has to do it because the cause that he represents has to win, because otherwise the destiny of humanity would be destroyed. And Krishna tells Arjuna that he can only act in a divine way when he has truly surrendered his will to God, and he acts not from rage, not from revenge, but out of a great peace, knowing that his actions have been blessed and sanctioned by God, and with the view to win, but not in a ferocious and merciless way. When you look at the practice of the Prophet Muhammad, who is one of my great heroes and one of the supreme sacred activists of history, you see that he was absolutely not afraid to go into battle. He was, after all, not only a great prophet, a supreme mystic, but also a king and a general. But if you look carefully at the Quran, you see that the Quran lays down in very explicit sentences, in very explicit ways, exactly how to proceed. Women and children and materials and trees and the environment were never to be destroyed, and prisoners were always to be treated with mercy and generosity. And he himself showed that in his practice. So he really represented this principle of sacred action from a sacred consciousness, even in extreme circumstances. Another wonderful example would be the example of Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo, because of his deep passion for the evolution of a divine humanity, knew absolutely that the Nazis threatened the evolution of humanity, and knew perfectly well that they represented the darkest imaginable forces of evil, and that they were absolutely vowed to that evil, and that there was absolutely no way they could be stopped except by force. And this was one reason why he really challenged Gandhi. He said, "Do you really believe, Mahatma Gandhi, that by linking hands and singing and praying, the Jews could somehow escape the horror of the concentration camps? Of course not. We have to get together to stop the Nazis and to eliminate Nazism. Otherwise, the future of humanity is a futureless one." So Aurobindo is a very important evolutionary philosopher, perhaps the greatest of them all, and I think he's also what the greatest mystics are, which are realists. And I think what realism in our situation shows us is that we really have to be prepared for anything, and that if the future of humanity is at stake, then we will need to get together and oppose it by whatever means necessary, so as to prevent a monstrous abortion and the terrible death taking place. But again, the Dalai Lama's warning is a very important one. said, after all, that only those could be trusted to use the very dangerous and ambiguous weapon of violence if they had been trained in nonviolence. So anyone who wants to prepare themselves as a sacred activist for the potentially terrifying future needs to ground themselves in peace, needs to ground themselves in compassion, needs to ground themselves in an absolute surrender to the divine world, so that if they are called to take up force, they will only do so with the divine economy and the divine mercy and the divine compassion and the divine effectiveness.
I think it's also beneficial to remember that Gandhi was advocating some strategies that were much stronger than singing and holding hands, although maybe that was part of it. But non-cooperation was a strong part of his nonviolent program, and constructing self-sustaining systems was another part. And in terms of Hitler and the Nazis, Gandhi was advocating using nonviolence, and actually, when it was used, it seems to have worked and saved thousands and thousands of people. And just a few examples are the Rosenstrasse incident in Berlin, where thousands of Jewish husbands of German wives were taken by the Gestapo, and those wives demanded the release of those men, and they were released. And in Denmark, virtually all of the Jewish population was saved by non-cooperation and by getting those people to a place that was safe. And then in Le Chambon, France, this town collectively decided to be a safe haven for Jewish people. So I agree that in certain cases, force may be necessary, as you're saying, the Dalai Lama points out. But I think it is important to remember the vast possibilities of nonviolence that sometimes have been forgotten.
Absolutely, and I think that's one of the most important trainings that sacred activism needs to offer, is a training that can really explore all of the kinds of strategies that you're describing and really solidify them so that they can be used, because obviously the use of violence must be only the absolutely last resort after all of these strategies have been tried and exhausted. Thank you for pointing that out. It's very important.
The last thing I'd like to speak with you about, and I've very much been enjoying the conversation. Thank you, Andrew.
My great pleasure, John. Thank you.
I would like to hear about anger and what to do with anger, and in terms of being an activist and a spiritual practitioner. You write in The Hope that in today's world, it's not only our right to be angry, it's our responsibility. The question is, do we act out of anger or love? This is a constant question for me. A lot of activists around me kind of go along with this sort of bumper sticker thing that you're describing of, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. But then what about, what do you do with that anger? And if you are acting out of that anger, you're kind of just spreading more anger. So how to transform that anger into love?
Well, I think partly the greatest and most holy anger arises out of deep love. I think when Jesus overturned the tables in the temple with such fury, it was because he loved the sanctity of the direct connection of human beings with God, and he really felt that polluting the temple in that way with merchandise and with business was an abomination. So there is a holy anger, and that's very important. What's also important is to understand that in the greatest tantric and evolutionary mystical systems, we are given a way not of suppressing and repressing anger, but of transmuting anger into fierce compassion energy. And I think this is the clue for the sacred activist. Many mystics suppress and repress anger.
That looks like it was John Malkin's Wednesday show replayed. I'm not sure if it was a recent one. I think his show has always got some provocative material, often around nonviolence. You're tuned to the stream of freakradio.org, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides, butting into the end of the show, but that's what happens because it's kind of into our time here. Stay tuned for updates on protests that happened last weekend and a special interview with Mike Rhodes of Fresno on the interesting parallel situation in Fresno, how authorities there are claiming to be helping poor and homeless people but actually spending the money on other things and making things more difficult for them as part of essentially a gentrification effort in the city. Don't go away.
Yeah.
Man, that was two from a 11-year-old album by Dan Byrne, Beautiful Trees and Joe Van Gogh. Welcome to Free Radio's stream. I keep hearing rumors we're going to go back on the air, and who knows? It could happen any day now, so keep your radio in good repair, because it's certainly been requested of me often enough by people I meet on the street, and boy, I wish it were happening, and frankly, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's a lengthy bureaucratic process of having to go back to the Free Radio Collective to get permission to pay the appropriate people so that the stream goes to the transmitter. I don't know. But I know that Uncle Dennis is working on it, and if you have questions about it, you certainly can give him a call. And you can go give me a call, too, on other subjects on the same number. He comes on at 8 o'clock tonight with From the Cream to the Dregs. I will be doing Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, which is what you're listening to now for the next hour and 45 minutes. So the number here, in case you want to get in touch with either of us, is 831-427-3772. 831-427-3772. Off air, you can reach me at 423-4833, which is also HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which meets every Wednesday at 10:30 at the Sub Rosa Cafe down there in, I guess it's Spruce and Pacific. Or is it Sycamore and Pacific? All these trees look alike to me. But anyway, it's a block from Laurel and Pacific if you know the downtown Santa Cruz area. If you don't, ask somebody where the Sub Rosa Cafe is and come on down at 10:30 on Wednesday morning. It's free coffee. We discuss issues of criminalization of the poor and how they can be exposed, mocked, and ultimately overturned. That's kind of what HUF is about. And that's what a lot of the show is about. I'm going to now turn to some street interviews, which kind of been piling up on my mighty and, I should say, somewhat disabled tape recorder, but I think it's still operational, and hopefully it'll remain operational for a little while, long enough at least to get this out on the air. I want to remind you that in case you hear something that you want to hear again or have a question about and can't get through to me on the line here at 427-3772, you can hear it again on the archives, which are at the HUF website, hufsantacruz.org. If you have trouble reaching the HUF website, which has been out of commission for about a week, you can again give me a call on the HUF line, and I'll give you an alternate address and a way to get to older shows, which could sometimes be useful. Anyway, here's some stuff, street interviews, voices from Pacific Avenue and elsewhere in the downtown. Well, you be the judge.
A rather gloomy fellow in front of Joe's Pizza and Subs. It is, of course, Monday, the 4th of April. And you, in fact, used to be a radio man, Mr. Thin Man, who used to be chunkier. Can you please tell me your name again?
Dana Cruz.
And Dana, you are a person who finds the current avenue. I mean, we're well guarded by the hosts and the police. They keep us lawful. They're friendly. I mean, look at that. Who could want more than that?
I don't know. Well, you know, I could go over the hill to Los Gatos. Looks just like this now. What's the difference? I mean, Santa Cruz used to be a place, a mecca, you know, difference. I mean, okay, I can hear one guy standing in front of the closing down Borders store playing a lonely guitar on a street corner, strumming as loudly as he can. Nobody even pays attention walking by anymore, you know? And you look up and down the avenue, all the street artists and performers, they're pretty much gone now. They've blown away from here. You know, and all the tourists have to see is the same thing that any other community like Los Gatos would have to offer, which is basically a bunch of shops and a cement sidewalk. About all I got to say there.
Dana, you yourself were a radio broadcaster for how long?
Nearly a year with Free Radio.
And finally you left because?
People are too complacent. Not enough activity, not enough activism in our the climate's gone cold. That's what I'd have to say. Yeah.
In fact, before we even began this interview, you kind of looked at me and said, what's the point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What is the point, listeners?
Look around, look at all the other nations that are, look at all the other outcries in other nations. I mean, there's people like, literally like, screaming at their governments You know, and it's just there's a wash of complacency going on here. It scares me because I don't think people. I think we're way too insulated in America, folks. Wake up.
Unfortunately, this sounds true, but we wouldn't want this message to get spread too far, Dana. Naturally, I'm going to have to feed you some French fries and shut you up. Maybe possibly a small apartment.
I've been placated enough. I managed to, you know, somehow have the money to afford a huge meal for only $3 today.
Anyone drink water?
It's great, you know. I mean, yeah, we're such a complacent, lazy, and rich nation anymore, and to see the less fortunate people just walked over in society is really bad.
There you have it. You know, the unvarnished truth from Dana Cruz. Well, I've just been reminded of a terror tale. A tale of terror, something like that. One of those horror stories that about a very distinguished member of our community, Mr. Chip, who is, first name only, please. He goes by his first name, the executive director of the Downtown Association. You have a recollection of an incident that happened downtown involving a street youth named Yo-Yo, where Chip apparently got so upset with Yo-Yo that he whipped out a metal rod. Is that correct?
Yeah, I took it out of a newspaper stand in the side of the front of Quiznos, and first he threatened him and tried to strike him with that rod. Then afterwards, he came back and threatened Chip with a fake handgun. And was arrested the same day.
Threatened Yo-Yo with a handgun?
Fake handgun,
and
yeah.
And what was the reaction of Yo-Yo and the surrounding group of people?
Chip was taken to jail in the back of a Santa Cruz police car.
And afterwards, of course, patted on the back and elected to the executive directorship of the Downtown Association.
I suppose that's the way it goes, usually.
Well, you know, promotion is, in fact, you know, a good idea for people who are standing up for the values of our community against the ne'er-do-wells and people of that sort. I hadn't heard that story, or if I have, I've had a blackout, so I don't know. It's interesting. This has probably happened 3 or 4 years ago, you think?
Around the summer of 08, summer of 2008.
Thank you. And of course, this is another tale from Dana Cruz, who was on the you were on the air at that time, yes?
Not quite. I was just looking into getting on the air back then with London, and then later collaborated, got on the air, started a show, and held it for about 9 months.
I remember. That was the time when there actually was a farmer's market drum circle.
Yeah, and I promoted it heavily. In fact, my show aired 10 to noon on Wednesday mornings ahead of the drum circle in the farmer's market, and that was one of the things I touted on the most. And I still think it's the tragedy that we've lost that and that they expanded the farmer's market, mostly in retaliation of people's freedom to assemble.
Well, I know also that there's an attack on what it seems to be an attack on the counterculture against Jabberwock, which you may have heard about. Jabberwock is a local head shop.
Yeah, I'm familiar with some of the people and stuff that's involved with that. Yeah, I feel bad about it, you know, because it's just another one of those things in the community that where a person's trying to find their niche and they're getting shoved out by other interests.
But luckily we have First Alarm Security keeping an eye on things.
Well, yeah, in case anybody wants to, you know, do something personal, like light up on a sidewalk or something, you can get reminded that you might be, you know, fined or thrown in jail or something.
Or possibly they could give you a ticket as a reminder.
Well, that's the fine, yeah, and that those could even lead to misdemeanors, which can lead to jail.
Well, yes, but the jails are places where the homeless can use to have lodging.
Yeah, 3 free meals and a cot.
If you like bologna sandwiches.
Well, nothing's free. Somebody had to pay for that, right? Didn't you pay for those tax monies?
Most of my money goes proudly to drone missiles over in Afghanistan. We've been talking with?
Dana Cruz.
Thank you, Dana.
In front of the parking space number, who knows what, right across from
722.
Actually, it's 4068. Well, 4068 is over there, but we're in the parking lot behind Logos talking with
Dreamcatcher
and
Sherianna.
And the two of you have just had some, you've been wed in Huli, you had sex, but you've been wed in Huli wedlock?
We had a computer wedding.
And you're both homeless.
Right.
No.
So you can get a wet chapel anywhere.
We're houseless at the moment.
But not homeless.
No. There's always a home. It's the sky above your head.
And I am literally.
As long as there's a priest in the house.
So what led you to this foolish choice, Dreamcatcher?
Trying to play a good fool.
And what about you, madam? Why would you possibly accept a catcher of dreams?
Well, it catches many things. Sometimes loogies.
I see we are becoming more and more seventh grade here.
Sometimes flies.
All right. That's,
sometimes dreams.
And sometimes dreams. I will leave it at that and wish you both a very happy next 50 years.
Lent.
There won't be a next 50.
Ah, there you are. The pessimist in you.
30.
All right. So.
And we'll have to pause while we decipher that last bit of gobbledygook. Don't go away.
So, it's about 7 o'clock, and I'm down here on Pacific Avenue in front of New Leaf, a little bit before 7, actually. And we have the variety of drummers and guitarists, a group of about 4, including Mark and Wayne and goodness, a whole bunch of folks. And then across the street in front of the going on down fast Borders are, looks like, 6 youthful hacky sackers sacky hacking away with so far no patrol or host interference, which is, of course, nice.
And hacky sacking, of course, is illegal on Pacific Avenue, anywhere in the down, and indeed anywhere in the downtown area, except in parks. So it's interesting to see the recurrence of kind of life on Pacific Avenue. An interesting contrast to Dana Cruz's perspective that we are sort of bereft of street music. And I think there is a really serious continuing repression of street musicians. I've talked about the specifics, whether you're trying to sing downtown with homeless lyrics or play a small keyboard near Borders and the attorney upstairs doesn't like it. Or, I don't know, whether you're beating a drum like Tamarack, or whether you're displaying jewelry, which this isn't having to do with street performers, but more like street life, and you're getting hassled, or whether you're in a store and getting raided by the police and then ousted by the landlord for what sounds like opportunistic reasons around real what may really be a cultural war against a store like Jabberwock. There is a crackdown on Pacific Avenue and around in downtown area, and it's not unrelated to the makeup of the current city council, which includes Mayor Ryan Coonerty, Vice Mayor Don Lane, Lynn Robinson, Hillary Bryant, David Teresis, and other right-wingers or right-wing collaborationists around this whole situation. Hoping to get a report from Street Performers Guild activist Tom Noddy one of these weeks. He's kind of on tour and working in different cities. He's the famous bubble-blowing maestro who's also been instrumental in challenging some of the downtown ordinances at different times successfully and putting in a lot of energy trying to get people together to discuss the issues and maybe act on them if they feel so inclined and could come to some kind of consensus. Though that hasn't happened recently. We have had a couple of meetings, actually had one meeting, and there's a promise of another thanks to SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression activist Coral Brune, who drew together a number of activists to talk about the new repressive or confusing police practices regarding sound amplification, where that's applied to things like a keyboard, played at a low volume, or even not really played much at all, but used as a rhythmic backup to an acoustic singer, where string stroker Sue Hamilton, who's been on this show, got a citation and essentially had a $250, was it? Or $465 bail. I think it was reduced to a smaller sentence, even though she wasn't, she said, warned. Police officer Warren claimed she was. There was a difference of opinion there. But there seems to be a real inclination not to even work in accommodating even both sides who may find, have different interests. Somebody who finds music uncomfortable or unpleasant in a situation on another side and that is enjoying playing it or enjoying listening to it. The issues can be worked out, particularly since Sue is willing to move along, although I think the move along situation should not be a matter of snapping your fingers if you're a heckler and getting any musician you don't like to move along at the at your whim, because the police department and the city attorney will back you up with a prosecution, which seems to be what's been in the cards, at least for a couple of cases in the last year. And that's kind of an ominous precedent seems to have been set, although we are still appealing the downtown convictions of myself, Becky Johnson, and Robert Blind Bear Facer. Here's some more from the interviews of... this sounds like April 4th, downtown Pacific Avenue. And there's a lot of contrast about, you know, when their street performers do show up downtown, some of them. Mr. Twister's been around. Jay and Leoni have been around. Mandolin Mark has been around. But if you ask any of them, I think they will talk to you about the repression they've been experiencing. And the kind of difficulties that they're having as street performers. They have to continue. They do it because they love to do it, or because they feel it's important to do, or because they do it because they need to make a little money. And it gets harder and harder in this economy, and particularly when the merchants and the police are methodically using these ordinances and interpreting ordinances in ways that really give a very severe kind of commercial veto to any merchant or property renter who wants to shut down a First Amendment activity along the sidewalk, regardless of what the Constitution says, or even regardless of what the actual wording of the local ordinances are. That was my discovery as I tried to advise people to follow the wording of the Unreasonably Disturbing Noise Ordinance when we advise people to tell the police officer, ask them, you know, are you fine where our noise unreasonably disturbing? And we found the police have adopted a new gambit. Or we won't tell you. It's not our opinion. It's somebody else's opinion. Because, of course, there isn't any objective standard for unreasonably disturbing. It's a ridiculous ordinance in that regard. There's no decibel requirement. And if you try to present contrary testimony, the real issue is going to be, did you follow the orders of the police officer, regardless of how loudly you were playing, simply on the basis of a complaint, which is not, of course, what the ordinance says. It does have a standard, unreasonably disturbing. It doesn't mean disturbing. It means unreasonably disturbing beyond a certain area. We're talking about music played during the day from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Anyway, let's hear some more from Pacific Avenue, some more voices and perhaps some notes from the street.
Mark Brody.
Mark, you said the local CVS gave you an unusual reception recently?
Yeah, the security people made me take my backpack off and leave it by the front door. And in the time it took me to go get some cigarettes and come back, somebody stole my backpack that had a $100 chess set, a $100 chess clock, my personal drawing tablet with a lot of sentimental to me drawings and other personal items, and it all got stolen. And the security people at CVS said, well, it's not our responsibility, even though they made me take it off.
Now, when was this?
It happened about a month ago. So this is April 4th. It happened somewhere around the beginning of March.
Have you ever had this experience before at CVS or any other store?
No, no. They had never in the past ever asked me to remove my backpack. They had no reason to ask me to remove my backpack. and I was just coming in to make a purchase. I shop there all the time, almost on a daily basis, and because of their crap, I wound up losing about $300 worth of belongings and irreplaceable personal items.
Had you ever been to CVS with a backpack before?
Yeah, many, many times.
Well, you're just a dirty hippie scum who's a likely kleptomaniac. That was the reason they went after you. Don't you understand?
Yeah, I do understand, unfortunately. That's their thinking. It's sickening, it's unfair, it's disgusting, and it cost me a lot, and I feel like they are responsible, and they ought to pay me back for my damn chess set and clock.
Have you put in a claim with them?
No. Maybe I need to file a small a civil thing in small claims court.
It's an interesting question. You need to find out. Gee, I wish if you come to a Huff meeting, maybe we can get, or maybe I can put you in touch with somebody who can help you with that issue. Are you still giving chess lessons?
Yes, I am still giving chess lessons, and my number is 359-3931. I'm a national master of chess, and I give lessons. I charge $20 an hour or a sliding scale depending on the economic situation of the student.
Indeed. Again, the number is?
359-3931.
And I must say that I did enjoy the chess lesson I had, and at a considerably reduced rate, but you were being very generous that day to people walking by on the street. You were giving lessons to people as they walked by.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, play a game for $2 and get an analysis of why you lost the game. Hopefully. Every once in a blue moon, I lose one, but it's not often.
I'll keep working at it. We've been talking with
Mark D. Brody.
Thank you, Mark. So, Mark, not only are you a chess master or expert, which?
Master.
Master, and you are masters above an expert and a grandmaster above a master.
That's
those
right.
You also are houseless at the moment, and you also lost your van in, under unusual circumstances?
That's right, and I consider this unconstitutional. A few weeks before I lost my chess set, I had a van that was paid for, smog inspected, registered, and I had scheduled an appointment for my son to take the road test to get his license. He had already passed the written test and got the driving permit. We were going to get him his license. It was scheduled 3 more days away. I got pulled over in the van, and because my license is suspended, they impounded the van for 30 days at $75 a day for storage, which is way far greater than the cost of the van. So they basically just stole my van from me without a trial or anything, just under, you know, the police claiming they have some reason or some probable cause that empowers them to take my property from me for 30 days. And so I lost my van, which was my home, my and my son's home. They just took everything from us. And I, God knows, I just don't consider it fair. I don't consider it constitutional. I don't consider it legal. They need to do something to turn that around and stop that. That is just like somehow they have authorized law enforcement to just legally rob you of everything you have.
If you're poor, we don't give a shit.
They don't give a shit, to put it bluntly. They worse than don't give a damn. They actually, it's like they want to inflict pain on the bottom rungs of society, the people that are have the least and are struggling the hardest to survive. They want to just keep driving them farther down and taking everything they have and making it impossible for a person to pull himself up.
Now, you probably you may or may not, probably haven't heard, there's going to be a protest on March 11th, a week from today, at
March
the county
11th.
Building. I'm sorry, April 11th.
Okay.
Thank you. That is at the county building, right in front of the courts, actually. We're doing a 10 o'clock meal and protest, Monday the 11th of April. We had thought that the armory was closing the day before. Now, I've gotten some information that it may have closed yesterday. I'm not sure what the story is with the armory. But in any case...
The story was that it indeed did close, I believe, on May 3rd, as we had thought. But we got misinformation via the Homeless Service Center, who apparently, or the attorney, city attorney's office, or somebody... who falsely informed Steve Plage that it was closing a week later, so we postponed the protest, which isn't altering the situation. People still are now outside with, essentially, there are 48, there's no actually walk-in emergency shelter beds that I'm aware of in Santa Cruz. There are programs you can get on waiting lists, but if you want to walk into a program or walk into a bed somewhere, walk into a shelter, you used to be able to at least line up and at the Homeless Service Center outside for the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program vans that would look for take you to churches, and there weren't many of them, and there people were always getting there was never enough beds for people, but at least in theory you could possibly get involved, though actually for the last decade that whole thing has also been full with people who are vulnerable and disabled, going elderly, single women, things of that sort. Still, it was at least formally a program where you could have emergency shelter. There is no emergency shelter anymore that I'm aware of. There is the Paul Lee Loft, which is a program you get into, you know, provided you're on their waiting list and you stay on their waiting list for a month, 2 weeks to 6 weeks, actually, depending whether you're a woman or a man or what the exigencies of the moment are, and then you may get in for a month, and then you'll be out for another month. So the fact of the matter is the situation for people is 95% of the homeless population is outside on the streets, and all of them are vulnerable to the city's municipal codes, which make it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night, so-called sleeping ban, which is exactly and specifically what it is. It bans sleeping. That is an infraction crime. The bail for which is, I had thought was $97, but has gone up to, I believe it's now $145. I saw a citation at the protest, which one homeless person showed me. And apparently it's costing more than it used to. I don't know where they got the extra $50 from, but it's gone up. And what happens then is people go to court, and they have to... apparently, you can't get a letter anymore, or I've heard it's difficult to get a letter from the Homeless Service Center stating we were full that night. Unless you happen to have the foresight or collusion with the Homeless Service Center to help swell their grant list so they can show whether they're serving more people and get more money from the government and from other sources, perhaps. If you're not on their waiting list the night you get a ticket, then... at least last summer, when the Peace Camp 2010 was trying to get some of the members of the Peace Camp who were sleeping outside, tried to get letters that said we were full, the Homeless Service Center was full during the nights the tickets were issued, they wouldn't give them that letter. So this is going to come up in the trials of the Peace Camp 2010 people in the late spring, I guess, coming up actually later this month and in May. Linda LeMaster and the Peace Camp 6, who I like to call the Santa Cruz 6, should probably call them, it's been suggested by Becky Johnson, the Santa Cruz 7, the seven people who are standing up to the penal code, curious and bizarre use of penal code 647E, which is a disorderly conduct statute. It's being used to criminalize political protesters who are peacefully and quietly protesting and or sleeping in front of a government building to demonstrate in the most vivid possible way and protest, not so much the lack of shelter, which it would be nice if there were shelter, but the fact that homeless people who are not sheltered are facing criminal charges with all the disabilities that that entails. And the protest we had I will be playing some tape from later today, I hope, in this show if I have time. But that is, the situation is there is no emergency walk-in shelter at the present time, and the allegation that there is essentially a lie that is being spread to justify and prettify the Homeless Services Center's approach. And it really, well, I find it extremely disagreeable, and I also find that it's very telling that they won't give you straight answers to questions when you send them emails, when you ask them questions publicly, even if you go to Don Lane, the vice mayor, who's on the board of the Homeless Services Center, or Catherine Byers. You cannot get a straight answer from them in terms of what are the procedures for getting on the waiting list? Can you stay on the waiting list? Will you give us a receipt? Actually, some of these questions are answered, but they're answered in ways that make it difficult for you to use these procedures, or that make it obvious that they're not really making things helpful for people who are getting on these lists. So, for example, they won't give you an acknowledgement, any written proof that you're on the list, what we call a receipt, which then might be used to show the police officer who comes around late at night and says, "Hey, you, you know, get going, show me your ID. I'm going to look through your property here," and asking you a series of questions that you should have no obligation to answer or pay any attention to, because you aren't engaging in criminal activity. But because you don't have any evidence that you're on the waiting list, the police officer is not influenced or bound by the new law, which was passed by the city attorney, or at the instigation of the city attorney last September, which says if you are on a waiting list for the Homeless Service Center or for the River Street Shelter, or if the Winter Armory Shelter is full, then, first of all, your tickets will be dismissed if you're given tickets for the nights you were on the waiting list or the armory was full. And on those nights that you are given those citations, the law shall not apply to you. It's the second part of the law that's interesting, because if you present evidence to an officer that you are, in fact, meeting those conditions, the officer's responsibility, it would seem to me, is not to give you a ticket at all, because you're not subject to the law. And when I talked to other legal experts, they said, oh, no, what they really mean here is that you can present that in court as a defense. But I would argue that you can present it to the police officer and say, back off, or I'll sue you later, and we'll see where that one goes. Because it says here that in the law that this law does not apply to people who are on the waiting list, and this is a receipt that shows I'm on the waiting list. And that may be the very reason that the Homeless Service Center refuses to give those receipts, because they wish to maintain a cozy and amicable relationship with the police. I can't think of any other reason. And that's been the case for 9 months since we went, myself, attorney activist Ed Fry, former Homeless Issues Task Force chair, and now Peace Camp 2010 defendant Linda LeMaster, we went to the Homeless Service Center Board of Directors to request that they do this, and ask them if they weren't going to do this, why wouldn't they do this? And we couldn't get a straight answer. All we got was, oh, we'll have to talk to the police department about that. We're not aware they ever did talk to the police department. All we know is that the city attorney does dismiss some citations, a fraction of the citations that are issued for sleeping, camping, or covering up with blankets each month. And I guess the claim is that the city attorney is dismissing all citations for those who are on the waiting list the nights of the citations. But the idea that you should be on a phantom and bogus waiting list that may or may not get you a bed in order to have the police leave you alone sounds like a combination of unnecessary and burdensome, as well as rather offensive kind of hypocrisy that's being used here, as well as a scam to get people to jump on the Homeless Service Center's programs. Even if they don't like the Homeless Service Center, even if they have some other philosophy of life, even if they've had bad experiences with the Homeless Service Center. And again, this is not to say that everything the Homeless Service Center does is wrong or bad, but this particular practice has been so persistent, their refusal to come clean, to write a letter saying, we have no space and we have no walk-in shelter. There was no space last summer, which would have been one way of essentially exposing the fraud of all the citations issued to homeless activists last August, September in October and in July as well, under when they were protesting at City Hall under the sleeping ban, the camping ordinance, and under 647E, the lodging law, because that means that if no such shelter existed, the necessity defense would win in court, because homeless people who have no place to go have a necessity to sleep at night. And that is supposed to be the basis for, and has been the basis for, even pretrial dismissal of these kinds of tickets. When a referee, or I should say Commissioner Baskett, sees a citation and a letter from the Homeless Service Center saying, we were full that night, she tells me she dismisses such tickets automatically. So because the Homeless Service Center is no longer apparently issuing those letters, and if they are, I'm glad to hear it, but I've heard the opposite, and since they refused to honestly state that they had no space throughout last summer, except for those on a waiting list in a very limited way, but not for people who came up that night looking for a place to sleep, they are, in fact, trying to create the illusion, or going along with the police illusion, that somehow there is shelter that people are turning down and they're instead choosing to sleep outside rather than sleep in the shelter, which may actually be a healthy choice, but is not the real situation. And they are, in fact, enabling police mistreatment of homeless people through this kind of mythology, through suggesting, well, we have a, you know, we're not going to issue a letter honestly telling the courts and the public what's really going on. We're not going to give you a receipt that says you're on a waiting list so you can show it to the police officer so he has to back off. We're not going to have, and this is another thing, somebody on call who will tell the police department if they call in, we have no shelter tonight, please don't issue tickets, which is what you would think a decent homeless service center really concerned with real homeless services, which have to do in the most basic service, allowing people to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere legally at night, something that they would do if they had some real concerns, other than the kind of limited bureaucratic concerns of assisting a small number of people, and, of course, those people who are employed in those positions as social service workers, bureaucrats, and on the board. The boards actually don't get paid, but the people who are running the place do. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse, and we aren't 101-ing, we're freak radioing. We are streaming, but I am hearing rumblings that there's kind of a rebellion in the collective to get this whole situation changed back so that we can actually get on the air again. We seem to be waiting for action from people who are at the transmitter site who are either, frankly, incompetent or indifferent or are having some problems I just cannot fathom. So I'm not trying to put them down. I am a little, frankly, upset that this is taking so long to do, and I hope that it changes soon, and I hope we can get back on the air soon. Again, the call-in number here, if you have any thoughts, all you stream listeners, is 427-3772. Let's hear some more from Mark, the chess expert, talking about his difficulties losing his van, his backpack, and suffering the kinds of things that would drive me crazy, I'll tell you.
Dramatize the fact that there's no place for the 75 to 100 people are being kicked out, that the city attorney is getting 200 plus grand to actually go after people and enforce not the suspended driving license. That's with the highway patrol. But I guess the city police, which police department went after you for that?
It was the city police. And I begged them not to take it. I explained that that was our home, that that was everything that I had. And they were very cruel and said, this isn't, let's make a deal. And they just left us there on the side of the road with nothing and took my home.
Who was the officer involved, do you remember?
I wish I did. I don't even remember their name.
How many police officers?
Two.
And did they say that if you could find a driver who was registered, it would let you take the van yourself?
No. And I pulled over in a legal parking spot, and I said that I would go find somebody that was a legal driver to move it to where we could stay until I got the rest of the things taken care of to for it to be completely legal for my son to drive it and get it insured. And they didn't even give me a chance to do that. I mean, I was right across the street from the shelter where I know a lot of people. I know some people that have a license that could have, you know, come and driven for me, but no, they wouldn't even give me a chance to do that.
Is that Coral Street?
Right on Highway 1, near a block away from Coral Street, near the right at the intersection of Highway 1 and 9.
How did they happen to pull you over?
That's another good question. I don't feel like they had any probable cause to even pull me over in the first place because the vehicle was registered. I didn't do any wrong maneuver in my driving. They gave no reason as to why they pulled me over. They just said, let me see your license. I showed them my ID. I told them I had a North Carolina license. They did some kind of check and said it's suspended and, you know, we're taking your vehicle.
No. Did you know your license was suspended when you were driving?
No, I didn't, but, you know, they didn't care about that.
Was it suspended because it had expired, or what was the reason?
I'm not even sure what the reason is, but, you know, like I said, I was in the process of trying to get my son licensed, and he had a permit, but they said he couldn't even drive it because even though he had a permit, there would have to be an adult in the car that had a driver's license with him in order for him to be able to drive. And so since they said I was suspended, I didn't qualify, so he couldn't even take over driving it, even though we were both sober and, you know, like I said, I pulled over in a legal place to stop the vehicle, and they called the towing company instantly. I mean, the towing vehicle got there before they finished writing out the ticket for
almost
driving.
Almost like a racket.
Not almost like. It is a racket.
And what was the name of the towing company?
Rossi Towing. That's who works for our local police department, our law enforcement. That's who runs this little racket. I almost feel like I should try to go to the federal building and file some kind of civil suit against the police department and Rossi's Towing for racketeering. Do you even know where is the federal building for our district?
I mean, we don't really have a, I mean, San Jose probably has a federal building, but, I mean, you can go, there's a federal office in the sense that I think there's an FBI office in town somewhere, and I also think there is a, I know there's an office of Representative U.S., Representative Farr, a congressional rep, in the county building. I guess the third, fourth, or fifth floor is one of the two, but that is not... The federal courts are in San Jose.
Okay.
Not that they necessarily are helpful, but, you know, the issues you raise are, of course, important to poor people, and people even who aren't homeless, but people who have vehicles who can't afford to drive it or have suddenly gotten fines for one reason or another, can't pay them, their licenses get suspended, and then they're screwed. They can't get to work.
Yeah, let me speak. It's horrible. They've made it to where... people like me, and I'm sure I'm not alone, there's probably hundreds of others, they get you in a situation where it would cost you so many thousands of dollars that basically the bottom line is you're never going to get to drive for the rest of your life. So they've really screwed you, and you're probably right. These federal districts usually encompass a number of counties, and it probably is over the hill in San Jose. And I'm going to find out where it is, and I think I am going to try to file a civil suit against the city and try to change some of these policies, because fortunately... my experience, I've been through some things like this in other states in the United States, And normally, when you go to the federal building, they don't give a shit about what local municipalities and so forth say. They go by the federal rules. And if you want to file a suit, they'll help you. They'll give you the paperwork. They'll say this is what you need to fill out to file a civil suit. And they will read it and give it consideration, and if it has any merit whatsoever, they will pursue the civil
suit.
Have
you filed a federal suit before?
Yes, I have. I filed a civil suit against the county jail in the capital of North Carolina because they would not give dental service to people who were going to be in jail for a long time, who had not been tried yet, not convicted of anything, but had been given real high bails that they could not meet, and so they're like forced to sit there and let their teeth rot, and the only thing they'll do is pull a tooth. They won't let you get any kind of real dental work there. And I filed a civil suit over that. And I don't know whatever became of it because I finally got sick of that hog farming, tobacco chewing, Bible thumping, backwoods, illiterate state, and I left before I ever found out what happened. But I
now you've come to enlightened Santa Cruz.
I've come to a supposedly more enlightened part of the country, but
they frightened you of your van and of your backpack.
Yeah, I've learned that things have begun to go downhill even here, and it saddens me.
Again, we've been talking with
Mark Brody,
who can be found as a chess maestro at
downtown on Pacific Avenue normally, and my phone number is 359-3931.
Thanks, Mark. I'm talking again a few minutes later after a masterful chess lesson where I just got badly beaten. The Latvian gambit loses again. But I've learned that you had a serious incident, not only in terms of a loss of your backpack and a loss of your vehicle, but your son was also involved after we talked about this on Free Radio before when you and I had a previous interview. How he stole a T-shirt.
That's right.
At one point, and he was charged with a felony.
That's right. He stole a $10 T-shirt. They charged him with a felony, robbery, I guess they called it, and he was released on his own recognizance. And then a few weeks later, after he was released, we were sitting one night in the comfort of our apartment where we moved in with this girlfriend of his. And one night, there's like seriously heavy banging on the door over and over, which I ignored.
Not what time of night?
Getting towards 10 o'clock at night, I was in bed trying to go to sleep at the time. I wasn't feeling that well. And they bang on the door a while, and since I ignored it, they shine flashlights in the window, but my bed was hidden behind a sheet, so they couldn't really see my face. And after about 15 minutes of this banging, no announcement, no verbiage of any kind, they go, either open up or we're going to kick the door in and come in and grab David. Still no identification of who they are or why they were saying this. So finally, I wanted to know because I was feeling like maybe it's somebody that has a beef with him. Maybe I'm in some danger here. Do I need to call the police?
We're going to have to wait on that because we have a scheduled interview now with Mike Rhodes of Fresno. I think that's Mike calling in now, but we'll find out. Hey there, you're on Free Radio Stream.
Hey, Robert, it's Mike Rhodes in Fresno.
Just as I suspected, the evil Mike Rhodes.
That's me.
Are you the man who's been writing these treasonous stories attacking Fresno First Steps Home and other well-intended officials of the city of Fresno?
Well, that might be what some of the city officials would say, but I would say that I'm printing the truth.
Printing the truth, but sometimes the truth is ill-advised because the public doesn't know what to do with it. Aren't you creating a difficult situation for our city officials in Fresno?
Well, here's the thing, is that city policy is leaving homeless people in Fresno to die on the streets. There have been so many deaths in the last year, and I would say it's directly attributable to city policy, which leads to people literally dying on the streets. And so, you know, you got to balance, you know, whether the truth about city policy is it worse to know that, or is it worse for people to be dying because of it?
Well, for those who are interested, Mike, I know you've written an article. And it's online, Fresno First Steps Home at indiebay.org/Central Valley. Fresno First Steps Home. I guess if people Google for Mike Rhodes, Fresno First Steps Home, they can find it too. In this, you have some photos of the hill, one of the homeless encampments. And you're asking, is Fresno First Steps Home helping to end homelessness, or is it part of a right-wing scheme to create the illusion that the city is doing something while things get worse and worse for the homeless? It sounds like a rhetorical question, actually, but maybe it's a serious one because you have seriously given people like former homeless czar Greg, what was Barson, was that his name?
It's Greg Barfield.
Barfield, thank you. You've given him a lot of rope. You know, you've tried to, work with city officials in hoping to get dumpsters and water service and trash pickups and other amenities, not to mention decriminalization at some level for literally thousands of homeless people in Fresno, and yet... what you have is increasing number of encampments and yet increasing crackdown on homeless people both in and outside of encampments?
Yeah, you got to look back historically on what the city policy was regarding the homeless in Fresno. 5 years ago, they were simply coming through with bulldozers and taking tents and putting them in the back of garbage trucks and destroying all the property that homeless people had. And when we stopped that and they started talking about providing housing vouchers, to me that sounded like an improvement. But as time has gone by, I've come to the conclusion that there was a lack of sincerity on the part of the city of Fresno in providing housing for the homeless. And in fact, what their policy led to was the illusion that they're doing something to end homelessness without the substance of it. And one of the telling signs of this was almost immediately after the homeless czar was hired is they removed all funding for any homeless projects in the city of Fresno from the budget. And they set up a 501c3 nonprofit privatizing the effort to address homelessness. And what we found in asking some questions about where the money is gone, this program, Fresno First Steps Home, which is the name of the foundation, was brought out with great fanfare. The mayor and many others went on television encouraging people in Fresno not to give their money to the homeless because it would only be used for bad things, presumably food and things that would help them survive. So they wanted people to give them the money and not the homeless, and so that they could provide housing and get them off of the street. And that was what they said, that they want the money so that they could fund these homeless initiatives.
Now, this program began when? When did the mayor make this fine announcement?
It was in the early part of last year. So I'm thinking, you know, February, March, something like that. I have to go back and look exactly, but it's been going for about a year.
But in fact, prior to that, was there not, I don't know, $1 million in each annual budget to deal with homeless people that was simply unspent year after year?
Well, yeah, there was that. And the money that they did spend was poorly used. For example, I did convince them at one point to put some portable trash, some portable toilets and trash bins at an encampment. And it cost, they were being billed $13,000 a month for like three portable toilets and a trash bin. Something that should have cost about $200 or $300 was costing them $13,000, which is just ridiculous.
Those homeless people were probably destroying them and ruining them. Our former mayor, Mike Rotkin, has assured us that's why we can't have 24-hour bathrooms or porta-potties, because they all get destroyed.
Well, I have personally been paying for a couple of them out on F Street in downtown Fresno, and they're still there. They haven't been destroyed, and people use them, and they appreciate it. The city of Fresno also used a lot of their money to buy and put up a bunch of tool sheds, which they put on some property that is owned by the Poverello House. Poverello House is a social service agency here in Fresno. And so these tool sheds, which are just like tool sheds you'd put in your backyard and put tools in it, they put two homeless people per shed in these. They don't have running water, they don't have toilets, they don't have heating or cooling.
This is the famous dog houses for the homeless that we talked about 3 years ago, right?
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that the city of Fresno used their money for when they had it in their budget. But in the last year, they have removed all money for homelessness and set up this 501c3, a nonprofit organization, and encouraged people to donate to it. Well, people were asking me.
Well, now, neoliberals have always told us that, private enterprise can do it better. So what's the record now, private enterprise? I assume they've stepped in and made some major improvements?
People were asking me out on the street, what are they doing with the money? Because we haven't seen it. We don't see anything that's happening. I mean, the interesting thing, Robert, is that on the streets of Fresno, where homeless people live, there is no money at all going to help them. And they're just kind of on their own, recycling cans and, you know, doing odd jobs to keep themselves alive. But they know that there's millions of dollars coming into the city of Fresno to address the homeless issue. And where that money is going is mostly to HUD, and it's going to developers to develop some low-income housing, which is supposed to address homelessness. And so one of those projects is a 60-some unit project, and it'll build these units that will be single resident occupancy, some of them specified for mental health, homeless people who have mental health issues. And they're spending $9.1 million on that one project. And the developer that got the contract is the same guy who was the chairperson of writing the 10-year plan to end homelessness here. So it's kind of a tidy circle that they have. But the point being that the money to help homeless people isn't getting to where it needs to get, and that is, you know, basic public services for the homeless. And so this Fresno First Steps Home, I started making inquiries about where the money had gone about a week ago, and I got rebuffed by Greg Barfield, who was the homeless czar. He transferred to another position at City Hall, and he claims that they don't have to provide that information because this is not a City of Fresno project, so they're exempt from any California Public Record Act request. So I said, well, fine, who do I ask then about your financial record? And there was no response. Another homeless advocate in Fresno inquired about this issue because I said, hey, you know, do you care about what's happening with the money? And he wrote to Greg, and Greg responded to him, you know, as he would not respond to me because I've been somewhat critical of his actions recently. But he did respond to this other person who does support what the city is doing, but does nudge them to do better. So he responded to this person by saying, well, we haven't really spent very much of the money. What we have spent it on is corporate filing fees and some promotional material for Fresno First Steps Home, which is probably these cards that they hand out to people telling them to call. They hand these cards out to people who want to help the homeless. So if a homeless person asks them for money, they give them a card that suggests they call 211, which then, I don't know, I've never called it, but I presume that it's sort of a directory or referral network where they say, oh, well, you could go to the Poverello House to get a meal, or you can go to the Rescue Mission and spend the night. But
why not? Why can't they do that? What are you, some kind of malcontent, Mike? I mean, you know, here they are providing all these services, and on top of that, small cards directing the handicapped homeless how to use a phone, presuming they can find 50 cents. Of course, that might be involved panhandling, to make a phone call. You have some objection to this whole procedure?
Well, I think it creates an illusion that the city is actually doing something about homelessness when, in fact, they're not. And look, if somebody were to call, there's not Fresno's different than Santa Cruz in that there's approximately 15,000 homeless people here, many of them on the streets of Fresno, some of them sleeping in cars, some of them on couches. There's about 250 beds, shelter beds in Fresno that are full all the time. So somebody is told to call the Rescue Mission or some other place for a bed. They're just not available. So it gives the illusion that there's some answer there, but there is in fact not. And the fact that all that this Fresno First Steps Home has done with their money is to pay for corporate filing fees and promotion for themselves and their program, which doesn't help homeless people, is, you know, pretty discouraging, and I think needs to be exposed to the public.
You know, I know that, I mean, I, of course, obviously, but the fact is, it's interesting, you've exposed prior schemes by prior mayors and prior failures to give away this money, and in fact, it was due to your intervention and that of a number of other people. Your daughter with a camera or a video, which resulted in the famous Kincaid lawsuit, which I guess sort of stopped them from destroying tents, although I guess they're now, what, carting them away to places where they keep them in waterlogged areas where they get ruined anyway, right?
Well, it did get their attention. And for whether it's good or bad, lawsuits tend to get the attention of the city of Fresno. And sometimes that's the only thing that does. So once there was this $2.3 million settlement, which was based around their taking and immediately destroying homeless people's property, they did change their policy. And the policy then became that they have to store homeless people's property for 90 days.
But as I said, you found that the storage facilities, at least in one or several cases, was such that it damaged the property beyond use.
Well, yeah. The first instance when they conducted a cleanup, as they call them, out by Roding Park and hauled homeless people's property away, I took a homeless woman down to reclaim her property about 2 weeks later, and they had put this big container that was open on the top out in a lot, a parking lot.
Well, that's a step forward from what they do in Santa Cruz. I went over to reclaim homeless property that was taken in the Peace Camp 2010 protests of last summer, and it has simply been left out in the rain in the back of the police station for 3 months. Some of it was in plastic bags and was okay. The signs that we were using were ruined. And the tables were, one of the tables at least was ruined. So it's, you know, it seems like police departments everywhere have a certain formula or a certain laissez-faire attitude for doing this. But what I was asking you, because we've talked about this, this is like 4 or 5 years old or 3 or 4 sure. years old, this discussion about this particular visit. And you've documented it. You've shown photos of it on indiebay.org/Central Valley. I'm asking you, has it improved? Is property still being taken? Is it being better stored? What's happening with that?
Actually, you know, after we released the video of their destroying homeless people's property, and we got the attorneys involved in the case to send a letter to the attorneys for the city, then it did change. They then put them in their property in cured containers that were sealed from the rain. So that did change. It's not ideal, but it did change.
And the other thing that changed is that
they stopped a lot of, they have a lot fewer of these cleanups taking place. In fact, they almost never do them anymore. And when they do a cleanup, they only take what is really garbage. And the way you know that is because what's happened in the encampment is the total abandonment of any city involvement in the encampments at all. And you could say, well, that's a good thing because the city's not attacking them, which is, yeah, that's better than them attacking homeless people. But what's happened is they, you know, you just have these huge piles of garbage. You know, they don't, there's no portable toilet, so people defecate everywhere. There's garbage and there's no drinking water. So it's a pretty bleak environment. And people have been forced. They have pushed people from any areas that are visible to the public. And so people are ending up on some pretty obscure places like, the hill where there's several pictures of that is way, south in the industrial part of the city. So, the city policy has shifted, but it's like shifted towards the complete abandonment of helping the homeless in any way. It's almost like they don't exist as far as the city is concerned. So,
what about police enforcement? You're saying there's no, police are simply ignoring homeless people sleeping at night provided they go to their ghetto?
I haven't had any complaints for a while now. The last complaint I had was back in January that the city police had come and were telling people that they had to move from F Street, which is an encampment just south of Ventura. And they threatened them, and the folks said that they weren't causing any harm. The police said, well, we've been getting complaints. The folks said, who's been complaining, and turns out the major complainant, at least according to the police, was Greg Barfield, who is the former homeless czar in Fresno. So they said, screw that, we're not going anywhere. And they didn't. And so the police came back a couple more times, threatened them a few more times, but they never did anything to force them to move. And they're there today. The encampment has gotten much larger.
Let me ask you about that. How many people are actually in encampments where, well, it sounds like conditions are sort of New York tenement style, but worse from the early 20th century, but still people have each other. How many people are actually gathered together in groups of the 15,000 homeless in Fresno?
Well, in the downtown area, I would put the number about 2,000. It might be 1,500, it might be 3,000. I don't really know, but it's a lot. And so in each of these encampments now, you have 100, 200, you know, maybe even 300 people in some of the bigger encampments. There's the one on Santa Fe, I have, I think, a picture up of that that is enormous and getting larger all the time.
What kind of organization are in these encampments? How do people address their own problems? What do they do? Have you had any reports or what's going on with respect to that?
It varies from camp to camp. People tend to go to camps where they're comfortable with. They know people there. They fit in. The camp on F Street, for example, I know they have meetings fairly regularly. There's a couple of people that sort of take some leadership role in things that, you know, pull people together to have meetings and talk about it. There, you know, I mentioned that we put these portable toilets down there, and so there was discussion about, okay, you know, what will our policy be on that? Some people wanted to lock them, and so people would have to come and get a key so that they could use them. And other people felt, well, just leave them open, and anybody could get in there. And the problem is that everybody uses them, and so they get filled up really quickly. We're trying to get to a point where we have so many of them there that that doesn't become a problem, but, you know, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So on F Street, you have some self-organization. There's some natural leadership there. They get together. They have meetings and talk these things through.
So is this are these the Hoovervilles or the Obamavilles, you know, of the 21st century?
Well, in Fresno, it does seem to be sort of developing that way. And in most other places that I've seen around the valley here and in, you know, San Francisco and Santa Cruz, I just don't see these large encampments that develop. And what starts to happen after a while, and what's happened here, is that people start putting more permanent structures up. They'll put foundations in, framed walls, pitched roofs, and pretty soon, you know, you have a regular neighborhood that just has no services that are being provided to it by the city of Fresno. There's no drinking water, no trash pickup, but for all other intents and purposes, it's just another neighborhood, although a very poor one.
And has that actually happened to F Street? Has that happened to any of these encampments? Their permanent structures have gone up and stayed up?
Yeah. I mean, F Street only started up about December of this last year. But over on H Street, there is an encampment there that's been there for several years now. And, I mean, it's just a permanent fixture of that neighborhood. There are row upon row upon row of houses that are built on a sidewalk and an abandoned overpass and under that overpass. And these have been there for years. I mean, they've even got at that encampment, they've set up, the homeless people that live there have set up a memorial for the homeless people in that area that have died. You can see a photo of that memorial where they have little gravestones for, you know, 40, 50 people.
Is there any active homeless organization from the grassroots of in these encampments that might draw them together to engage in some kind of united political action?
Hard to do. I mean, there's a lot of countervailing currents that take place within the homeless encampment, and I would love to see self-organization where people are organizing in their self-interest and becoming a political force in the community. But frankly, Robert, I haven't seen that. I know there are some good people out there that have good intentions, but as far as organization and that turning into political power, it hasn't developed yet.
What's the economy looking like in Fresno compared to a year ago in terms of employment and in terms of income, foreclosures, and so forth?
Well, our unemployment rate, you know, official unemployment rate is about 20%. There are interestingly, abandoned foreclosed homes everywhere. In fact, right across the street from the homeless encampment are several homes that are boarded up and abandoned, probably bank-owned. There are thousands of vacant homes in Fresno. There's more than enough housing here if it was used to meet people's needs, but obviously the banks are not opening those homes up for the people that need them.
And neither are the progressives and the homeless people themselves occupying those homes, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I wouldn't go so far as to say that people aren't occupying homes, but it's not something that is openly discussed as a strategy here. It's simply done from one, you know, with one group or another. It, you know, certainly homeless people can't break into houses and use them when they can. And the police's response to that usually is, when they find out about it, is that they'll go in and they'll ask people to leave. And they don't arrest them. They don't do much else. But, you know, what we suspect is if there was a politically led movement here to publicly take over bank-owned and foreclosed homes, that it would be targeted by the police and there would be repression. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, if people are doing that, good, because people need housing and housing should be a human right. But is there a organized effort to do that? Not that I know of.
Well, I know that last December, I believe it was, maybe I'm thinking of December before last, weren't you guys threatening to provide maps to all the foreclosed homes and going to distribute them if there wasn't some action by the city on some basic issue on homeless civil rights or homeless entitlements?
Yeah, we held a press conference, and that was in December of 2009 on Human Rights Day, and we had a big map that had a list, you know, pins in all the areas where homes were bank foreclosed and, you know, they're boarded up. So we did provide that map, and I think people did print them up and did distribute them. So, you know, but things change all the time. You'd have to have, you know, updated maps probably monthly in order to keep current. As far as I know, nobody's doing that.
I thought it was a great idea, actually. I mean, it went to really the heart of the issue, housing that was not being used and the people who needed to use it.
Very straightforward. Makes perfect sense.
You know, I don't think they have enough police to, if people occupy, if there was a general movement to occupy housing, it couldn't be stopped if it were done, you know, with sufficient, if it were done like is happening, what happened over in Tunisia and Egypt. Although there, of course, it's a movement for political rights and an end to the dictatorships, that the U.S. supported dictatorships there. But, you know, it could be, it's in other eras, it's happened that people have taken over what they need to take over.
Well, if the 15,000 or so homeless people in Fresno were to be politically united and develop a strategy of that nature, it would definitely shake things up a lot. The struggle here would move to a whole new level.
What about allied groups? Supposedly allied groups of the homeless people are kind of the pariahs. We have had union rallies where, you know, when one person mentions the homeless, everybody else sort of shudders and backs off, and union people don't send reps to homeless rallies and so forth. There's this division, ditto with student organizations, where you have these isolated circumstances happening. You're involved with you edit a newspaper, the Community Alliance newspaper,
right?
That involves itself in a number of issues, whether it's anti-war, environmental, gay, lesbian, bi, transsexual, human rights for youth, police abuse. All these are issues, and homeless issues, that your newspaper is trying to cover, right?
I think people at this point in this community see homeless rights issues, a right to housing, as being integral in the struggle for peace, social, and economic justice. They don't make a differentiation between that and police accountability or labor rights. It's just part of the environment.
But you can't get the unions down there to support the homeless, I'll bet.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Or can you? I'm amazed if you could.
Well, I mean, if there was something to focus people's attention on, we would probably get some union support. I mean, there's unions and there's unions. Different locals are more progressive than others.
Have any unions ever supported any homeless protests in the last 5 years?
Well, we've certainly had union organizers, staff, members come out to rallies and sleep-ins and the sorts of things that we've done. Now, if you're talking about officially sanctioned groups of union members coming out in an organized fashion, there's less of that. But on the other hand, really, I don't see any hostility from organized labor toward homeless people.
No, I mean, but in terms of activism to change the laws that criminalize the homeless or to, you know, end this, you'll get these protests, you know, supporting Wisconsin, as indeed people should be supporting, you know, the upsurge in Wisconsin against, well, to some extent against the attacks on labor there, but when, of course, if they really are supporting mostly Democratic Party policy positions instead of the real rights of working people, although some of that does come out, do you find ever, I mean, is there, well, you're saying that union people do show up at these rallies.
Well, the other thing, Robert, is like, okay, there was a march here about a week ago supporting labor rights because they're under attack. And, you know, I couldn't identify any homeless people at that march. You know, there wasn't any, you know, LGBT activists there either. What tends to happen here is that people have the issues that they are passionate about, and they focus narrowly on those issues. That's one of our challenges that we have, is to build a more united progressive movement. And, unfortunately, we're not there yet. And I, you know, as much as I would like to see that happen, and I encourage people to support each other's struggles, there's not enough of that does take place. And it's, you know, it's true. It works across all different issues.
What's on the horizon for the next few months in Fresno that people should know about? I know there's a Bank of America protest coming up on Monday in Santa Cruz. We've been having a variety of protests around the closing of the armory and the criminalization of the poor and the wars, expanding the wars in Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan. But what's happening in Fresno?
Well, probably a lot of the same things that are happening in Santa Cruz. There are people working on multiple fronts to try to build a more sane society. And, you know,
any specifics? Anything specific? Huh? Any specific events coming up that you might want to mention, or
one thing that kind of grabbed my attention lately is that there's a group that is trying to pull all the different progressive groups together in the fall for a conference in Fresno to build some kind of united strategy. They're going to bring in Jim Hightower to speak, and the strategy is to get people to get together and look at all the issues and figure out a way, if there's a way that we could all work together to build political power in this community that would benefit all of us. Because otherwise we're just a whole bunch of different groups, and they're all struggling against issues. And sometimes we have minor victories, and, you know, whenever we do, that's a great thing. But there's always something else over here that's coming up that's got to take our attention. And there's not enough unity to be an effective force. And so there's this effort that'll take place in the fall here that will, the goal is to get everybody together to try to build a common strategy. So you'd have, you know, people who are homeless advocates, you'd have people who are labor activists, people who are focusing on electoral strategies, who would all come together and see if there's unity that can be built that would benefit us all.
We've been talking with Mike Rhodes, Community Alliance editor, author of many different articles on homeless civil rights struggles on indiebay.org/Central Valley. Mike, I would probably keep throwing questions at you, but you told me you only had half an hour, and it's been 37 minutes.
So. Okay, well, Robert, I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I learn a lot by talking to you. You ask really good questions, and I just appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk to you from time to time.
Well, I'm a little, you know, I'm asking you a lot of gloomy stuff, and, you know, I'm... But you know, you're out there. I know very few people who are out there trying to fund porta potties. There were two people in Santa Cruz who tried to do that and did that for 3 months. Paul Lee and I guess Ed Fry facilitated that. But it's you know, it's rare. And we have a similar situation. There's this very grim sort of lack of understanding and lack of awareness that we're all in the, you know, increasingly close to that abyss, although I guess I'm told the economy is recovering. Is that true?
Not here. Hey, you know, I just throw out an idea. The way I'm able to pay for the portable toilet and the trash bin, we have a huge trash bin out there, too, and we'll probably be putting more out before long, but the way that I'm able to afford to do that is I've been taking, and it sort of has several benefits to it. I've been taking people out on tours of the homeless encampments in downtown Fresno. So I'll get 5 to 10 people and we'll walk around and I'll talk to them about, you know, the history of the struggle, of the current condition, where we're at now, how we got here. People will ask questions. I'll introduce them to homeless people. They'll talk and tell their story. And I charge people to do this, $20 each. And so that money goes into paying for the portable toilets and trash bin. And you'd be surprised at all the people that come. I've had people, you know, from the Democratic Party, from lots of students, lots of different people coming from different interests, but they want to see firsthand what's going on in the homeless encampment. And they're willing to pay for it. So
How can people join the? Do you have a regularly scheduled? I think I catch your drift. You're suggesting perhaps that could be done in Santa Cruz. But if somebody wanted to visit Fresno and join one of your tours of the Haight-Ashbury, no, I'm sorry, of the F Street encampments, for example, what would they do? How would they? Is it every Monday at 5 o'clock? I mean, when is it?
No, I've been setting them up. If people would email me, that would be the best way to get information about when the next tours will be.
Is it possible for you to actually make a video of one of these tours so you can then perhaps sell it or pass it on the Internet to those who can't make it to Fresno to see what's actually happening?
I hadn't gotten that far yet, but I'm sure that's a possibility.
I'd be happy to kick down a little from this end to try to help pay for some of the expenses, because that would be a valuable video to have, I think.
Yeah, I just did a PowerPoint presentation where I put a lot of pictures and some video in it and took it up to Merced, the university, last Saturday, and I was the keynote speaker there. Philip Mangano, who is sort of the national czar for homelessness, spoke later. He also spoke there, but I was able to frame the issue of homelessness and how to end it, and how what we should be doing to end homelessness. Philip Mangano is really an interesting guy because he has all this social justice rhetoric, but what his results are is that it leads to more of the same. And even though he talks about ending homelessness and that's what his goal is, the result here, and he came and did his dog and pony show here too, and the result was that it simply created the illusion that something was going to be done to end homelessness. It fooled a lot of people for a long time, but not anymore.
Really? So the Democrat, the city council of Fresno is turning around and looking for ways to reclaim their the money that is some being siphoned off by this 501c3 profit nonprofit that we were talking about originally that is, you know, buying doing corporate filings and PR but not doing anything toward really addressing homeless issues?
Well, no, I wouldn't go that far. I'm not saying that the politicians in Fresno are onto this yet. We're just starting to probe this and to put the information out there that we're finding out, and we're hopeful that it'll turn around. What I'm saying is that people here, homeless advocates, and the homeless people themselves are starting to realize that this whole effort by developing a 10-year plan and a 501c3 is a sham, and that it's not working, and that the money has been misused or not used at all to help the homeless.
Well, didn't we realize that like 10 years ago when they cooked up this Bush's 10-year plan to end homelessness bullshit, which, as you know, it's the continuum of care, all these different devices that have nothing to do, that are all cover devices for essentially, you know, whatever political action the development forces of the city want to do while, you know, shoving aside the real issue of civil rights and real services for homeless people. I don't know. I mean, that's how it seemed to me. They talk this issue to death, and that's what they do. That's their function. They get you to talk about it. And in a way, I criticize myself because I'm on the radio talking about this and have been doing for two decades, blah, blah, blah. I mean, occasionally I get out there and do a protest, and, you know, occasionally we do some feedings and we put out some literature, but, you know, the hard issues remain unaddressed in any continuous and consistent way. And I guess I was going to ask you this PowerPoint presentation you did up at Merced. Did you make a video or an audio of it? Is it available for us to view? Those of us who are unable to get to the university in Merced at the same time you were there.
Yeah. You know, I haven't put it anywhere. I should try to see if I could put that on IndieBay, and if I could figure out how to do it, and it will be on IndieBay / Central Valley.
That would be great.
Would be good.
Well, Mike, again, now you're really getting into the 45-minute zone, I've got to tell you. You probably got better things to do, like actually some real work or maybe make some money so you can actually pay for your mortgage or whatever. You own your home, right?
Yeah, I'm housed.
Yeah,
so,
that's good.
I'm really lucky to have a place to live. But I think talking with you and your audience is an important thing to do. Also, in addition to whatever writing or pictures I take, talking with you is just as important as all that. But I do have to go now, and I appreciate you giving me time on the air.
And give me your email address so folks, if they want to get in touch with you, can by email.
Sure, it's my name, Mike Rhodes, MikeRhodes, @comcast.net.
Hey. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks, Robert. Talk to you again soon.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye. And that was Mike Rhodes of Fresno. You can read his stuff and see his photos on IndieBay, IndieBay.org/Central Valley. And it's just look on the right side of the screen. You'll see some of his stories there along with other stories IndieBay has written or writers have put up on IndieBay. Impressive what he does. I wish I had the facility he does to do what he does. It's amazing, and he does this on a variety of issues. You can hear some of his older discussions on this issue if you go to the Huff website, which will soon be up again, we hope, and then just search for Rhodes, R-H-O-D-E-S. We have a caller. Amazing. Hi there. You're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hello, Robert. Sergio.
How's it going?
Study English, Hartnell College. Enjoy your show.
I'm glad. I'm glad, man.
I'm confused, Robert.
You are?
Well, you say, like, Steve Argue?
What are you confused about there, caller?
Well, he's an activist, right?
What's
Steve
that?
Argue?
Because I'm... sorry, say that again?
What? Steve Argue is an activist.
Oh,
is
Steve Argue, yes. What about Steve?
Well, Steve Argues. That's the correct English.
Oh, Steve Argues is what you're saying.
No, Steve Argues. That's how I am being taught English.
You I see. Well, Steve there you Argues. Go. I can't really comment on that, except that Steve Argue is... we actually... Was
okay. Forget about that. How about the lady who sold glass to the miners?
Who stole what?
The lady, the shopkeeper, head shop, you call it in this country, who sold glass to the miners.
Oh, who they alleged sold glass alleged. To the miners,
well,
yeah.
I mean, are you Japanese? She sold grass, no?
Well, both. They claim grass and glass, but of course this was...
Well, which one? You know.
I think they claim both, actually.
Well, you know, you have to clean up your act, man.
Well,
she argues, and it's grass she sold... And you just said that people go to Fresno to visit Haight-Ashbury?
Well, I was making a reference that in Haight-Ashbury they had these tour buses that would go through and show the hippies. Similarly, Mike Rhodes does a tour that shows the homeless, but I think he's doing it for a better purpose than commercial purposes, such as they used
to
do.
Well, you know, Robert, I've been in this country just for 6 months, and I think I'm going to leave it.
Well, what can I say, caller?
Well, because you know, Steve argued... She says grass. The tour. Haight-Ashbury. Haight-Ashbury was 68 months. This is the 21st century. Wake up!
Well, thank you, caller.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
And thank you for that call. It's always nice to know that somebody, however cranky they may sound, is listening down there. And thank you for calling in. I'm glad to hear you. We've got about 12 minutes before Uncle Dennis comes. Striding into the studio, hopefully with good news about his plans to actually get the station back on the air as well as being on the stream, though it sounds like we're hearing a few people. I'm going to play a little more of the street interview with Mark, the chess expert, who was talking about his son's situation when his son was stole a T-shirt. Actually, I don't even know if it was stolen. I heard a previous interview where the allegation was theft. But it wasn't necessarily what actually happened. We had an interview with Mark and his son David some months ago when I ran into him on the street. But anyway, let's hear a little bit of that because that's probably going to round out the rest of the hour, and then I'm going to be on the road, and we'll be back on Sunday, I think, unless I find something more meaningful to do with my life, which could always happen, folks. Watch out. That'll be Sunday at 9:30 in the morning, which you can check the show out again, and away we'll go. Let's hear some more of this interview from, I think it was April 4th or thereabouts, maybe a little later, talking with Mark, the chess master.
Verbiage of any kind, they go, either open up or we're going to kick the door in and come in and grab David. Still no identification of who they are or why they were saying this. So finally, I wanted to know because I was feeling like maybe it's somebody that has a beef with him. Maybe I'm in some danger here. Do I need to call the police? Do I need to get a weapon ready to bash somebody's head if they come in the door? And I went to the front door and I said, "Who the hell is it?" And then finally, at that point, they identified themselves as being deputies of the sheriff's office and said, "We have a warrant for David." So I was highly indignant about that because I think I thought they were required to identify themselves from the beginning. By going and banging on somebody's door and making a verbal threat like that without saying that they're representatives of law enforcement, they're lucky they didn't get shot. because I was in fear somebody was just simply trying to break into our home. And I think that's an egregious abuse of their authority or power or whatever, that they don't know. They should know, but apparently they don't know how they are supposed to do their job.
Now, how many deputies were there?
Two deputies.
What was the nature of the arrest warrant? What was it for?
They finally, after they said that they were deputies of the sheriff's office and that they did have a warrant, I let them in. They arrested my son.
Proper procedure is to say, slip the warrant under the door and I'll take a look at it. And you see if the warrant is properly put together. It identifies someone who's there. You know, it's dated properly, signed by a judge. Although I'm not often, you know, too conversant with the technicalities. That's what you're supposed to do, I'm told. Go ahead.
That sounds very reasonable to me, and they certainly didn't do anything of that kind.
You have to insist on it or they won't.
I see. And so when I did let them in, they finally said that they had a warrant to arrest David. And it wasn't until after I let them in and they found, located him and handcuffed him, that they finally said to him, "You're under arrest." And he said, "What for?" Because neither one of us had any idea what he had done wrong. And they said, "Domestic violence." Both of us were in shock. I said, "Against whom?" And they said, "His girlfriend, the
who had been gone for a number of weeks,
who had been gone for days, and apparently she had called them and filed a complaint against him, and with no physical evidence, no kind of bruise or harm, no visible harm to her, no witness, nothing but her saying that he did something, they generated a warrant and arrested him for domestic violence.
Currently in jail on that warrant?
And he is currently in jail. He went ahead and pleaded guilty for stealing the T-shirt. And although I heavily advised him against it, and she even said the next day when she showed up that she had no intention of pressing charges, that she just wanted to get rid of him, she immediately hopped in bed with this guy that was supposed to be one of my son's friends. And so that, I guess, is the bottom line. She wanted to get rid of him and get together with this other guy.
Why didn't you just say so? I mean, would he have left?
Yes, that's why I'm so hurt and insulted by the whole incident, because she knew she could have just come to me and said, "Dad, I don't really want to be with David anymore," and the two of us would have just promptly left within minutes, you know, or at least within the time it would have taken me to arrange somebody to come help me get our belongings out of there. That's all she had to do. And instead, she did that. And then my son, against my vigorous protest, pleaded guilty not only to stealing the T-shirt, which he did do, but he pleaded to domestic violence as well, and they gave him concurrent sentences of 120 days. You know, thank God they were...
Two felonies or misdemeanors?
I believe just a felony for the T-shirt. I think the violence...
A pretty expensive T-shirt.
It was a $10 T-shirt.
Yeah, but $10 goes a long way these days.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
But, you know, the domestic thing is just a misdemeanor. But he did agree to go to, treatment for domestic violence. He's going to have to be in therapy for a year. And if he messes up and misses some appointments or something and doesn't complete that course, they can revoke it and give him a year in prison. So I tried to convince him not to plead to that charge, because I don't feel he was guilty of it, but I think, you know, being in jail, you know how they torment you in jail, or maybe if you've never been, you don't know.
I've been in jail, but I mean, you do want to get out of jail.
You just want to get it over with.
You really have to realize that it's going to be much longer if you do.
Right, and so bottom line is, you know, he got 120 days in jail, and he'll be there for at least the next month and a half before he gets out. But I just resent the fact that she made that charge, then said that, no, I don't really want to press charges, but it's too late. She's already inflicted the damage, and now he's got that mark on him as, oh, he committed domestic violence. No, he didn't commit domestic violence.
Is there a backstory that you may not know between the two of them, you think, or you're pretty sure you know all the facts?
I don't know everything. I wasn't around them 24 hours a day, so who's to say? All I know is this. I saw her the very next day, and it's quite clear that there is no bruise, no limping, nothing hurting, nothing wrong with her, nothing that indicated to me that she had been the victim of any violence. I'm not a doctor, but I mean,
you gave a date when she said the violence happened, and you knew, you saw her the day after that date?
I don't know the exact date she was claiming that it occurred, and you know, I just have to confess I'm ignorant of all the facts, but I do know this. She said, I have no intention of pressing the charge, but it was too late.
And you haven't had conversations with her afterward since then?
I moved out as soon as I possibly could. I had to wait till I got my disability check on the first of this month, and as soon as that occurred, I picked up everything I owned and got out of there under the extreme urging from my counselor, who said she could make up a story about you and get you in trouble for some kind of sexual or physical assault under some kind of false pretenses. I strongly advise you to get out of there.
The name of the person involved, what's her name?
Cassie Perdue.
The name of your son?
My son is David Brody.
And of course, you are the world famous
Mark D. Brody.
A chess player to beat. Good luck.
The highly renowned author, painter, chess master, psychologist, and software engineer, Mark D. Brody.
Not to mention the soft-hearted Mark D. Brody.
Yeah, that's a fact.
You have a look. You look like you're soft-hearted. I can't tell. I've only seen you a couple times. Thank you, Mark.
And that's almost it for Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Looks like we may have a caller here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Sergio here. You say there are hippie chicks in Fresno?
My goodness. You're going to have to speak a little slower. I'm an old guy. My ears
saying,
are slow.
You say there are hippie chicks in Fresno?
Chicks in Fresno.
I can't find any hippie chicks out here.
I can't tell you, man. I'm in Santa Cruz. What can I say?
You talked to the guy in Fresno. You said they have Haight Ashbury tours.
No. They had Haight Ashbury tours in the Haight Ashbury in the 60s.
Well, why do you say that there must be hippie chicks? There are no hippie chicks up here. I have come here to meet some hippie chicks.
Well, I wish you luck with that.
Well, should I go to Fresno or Stanger?
Well, I'm going to leave that up to you.
You are disseminating false information.
Well, of course. What else would I do? I mean, this is free radio.
You know, you are a subversive.
That's a known fact.
You are using this information to basically overthrow the United States government.
But not doing it very effectively.
No. But you know, you find me a hippie chick tomorrow, I'll call you again. Thank you. Talk to Daniel.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, caller. You never can tell what kind of calls you're going to get at the end of the evening. So that's pretty much the story from my show, although Uncle Dennis is a little bit tardy in getting to the studio, but he should be here shortly. I was going to read a few other stories, which I did not have time to do. There, actually, tonight, even as I speak, and I should have announced it, there is a desal debate, a debate on whether to put in a desal plant. That is happening. Whoa, where is that happening? I was told on the phone, actually, where that was happening, and I want to make sure I actually have that, if I can get this thing to work. And I think I can. It's a little bit late to get to the desal debate, but I think it's still possible. It's at 900 High Street. It began at 7. I imagine it's going to go on for a little bit longer. That's at the First Congregationalist Church. And you can check that out if you get up there that way. You probably can hear more about it. Well, you can read Fred Geiger's account of the desal, what he regards as a boondoggle, in this week's Santa Cruz Weekly, which usually is pretty weak, but in this situation isn't as weak as it could be. The Weekly is less weak than, well, it's got a good letter by Fred Geiger. Other items that are not being attended to because I took the time to do other things are, as Uncle Dennis kind of tries to get it together, there is a, let's see, there was an ASA National Day of Action coming up. It's Americans for Safe Access, concerned with medical marijuana. On May 2nd, the day that Dale Schaefer and Molly Fry must surrender themselves to serve their five-year sentences, there are rallies being hosted across the country demanding patients' rights, with the main rallies in Sacramento, where Dale and Molly are surrendering themselves, and at the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. And there was actually, at 5 o'clock, a discussion of the details of planning that. But that was before the show, and it was before I had a chance to really get involved. Interesting article called I Want to Occupy You Forever about Iraq by Pepe Escobar. And I'm going to read a little bit of that until Dennis gets into the studio. He's back every time Iraqi nationalist Shiite cleric politician Muqtada al-Sadr resurfaces with a bang. The U.S. establishment shakes like a willow tree while U.S. corporate media duly dusts off the usual radical anti-American, Iran-friendly, firebrand cleric rhetoric. And you can check out that article, and that's on the, it's at atimes.com in case you want to check out Pepe Escobar's I Want to Occupy You Forever. And indeed, what's happening is Muqtada al-Sadr is saying over in Iraq that unless the U.S. keeps its word and gets the hell out of Iraq at the end of 2011 as it's supposed to do, it looks like they're going to restart the guerrilla war against what's already going on, add the Shiite contingent to the